Jeff Rentz here with Al Teitelbaum as we take a stroll through the golden age of Hollywood. Al and his father, Al, of course, taking the business over later, ran the biggest furrier business for the Hollywood movie community. And Al knew just about everybody. And he knew things that to this day he probably wouldn't talk about because there were different times and codes of conduct and all the rest of it back then. Tell us the story about Rita Hayworth, if you would.
Well, Columbia had made the picture Gilda, starring Glenn Ford and Rita Hayworth. And she was, at that time, one of the sex pots. She and Betty Grable were, at that time, the sex pots of Hollywood. They were the Marilyn Monroe of that era.
Mm-hmm.
And in the picture, Jean-Louis had designed these very sexy gowns for her, and also designed, it was a white ermine floor-length coat, but it was really made almost to fit her like a dress. And they wanted it to actually conform to every bit of her body.
And you made that.
We made that.
Yeah.
And when the picture was actually shown, it just showed her dragging the ermine that we had spent so much time on across the floor, off her back, and the rest of it on the floor, walking across the room.
Why? What happened?
Well, the idea was to show that she didn't care about anything. I mean, jewelry, furs, she was a gambler's mistress at the time in this movie, and they wanted to show that she didn't care about anything. And the idea was to show that here this several thousand dollar ermine wrap was just dragged as though it was nothing.
And several thousand dollars in the 40s was a lot of money.
It was a lot of money. And Jean-Louis was heartbroken, and so was I. We put a lot of work into that.
Now, he was the chief designer.
He was the chief designer at Columbia. And he was one of the best.
All right, let's get back to Howard Hughes. Now, you'd get a call. Mr. Hughes would like you to take a sampling of your furs over to, let's say, the Beverly Hills Hotel.
Okay.
How many would you pack up and take over there?
Well, usually I would bring about half a dozen, at that time, mostly mink stoles.
Uh-huh.
And they would pick out what they wanted.
Who's they, Al? You go to the Beverly Hills Hotel, you're, what, is escorted to one of the suites there or something?
You go up to one of the suites there, mm-hmm. and you're greeted by one of Howard Hughes' people, and mm-hmm. there's a girl in the room.
A girl.
And they pick out the fur that she liked.
And ordinarily this girl would be what, 18, 19, 20, that kind of thing?
Well,
a starlet?
A starlet, usually. Or a want-to-be starlet.
Yeah.
And I would put the rest of them in the valise and leave.
And that was it. But did the girl act embarrassed? Did she say, hi, Mr. Teitelbaum, or oh, I love this one, or I love that one, or what was it like in there?
Well, actually, it really, surprisingly, it was not embarrassing, seemingly, to the girl, and it wasn't embarrassing to me. Some of the girls I had known before.
Oh?
I had seen them do bit parts in different movies, you know? And they picked out what they wanted, and that was that. The next morning, I'd get a call and ask how much, the fur was, and I'd say 700, 800, 900, whatever it was. And they would say, well, are you going to be at the store? Will you be there at 10:30? I'd say, yes, of course I was going to be there at 10:30, because that meant that somebody was coming up with the money for the fur.
Yeah, you would be there, of course. Now, was the theory that Mr. Hughes was in an adjacent suite or somewhere, and the girl would walk out of the room and model it for him, or did that ever happen?
Well, she would usually take the fur and walk into another room, but I never saw Mr. Hughes there.
Ah, it's funny. So he was in there.
Oh, he was in there. Of course he was in there.
How interesting.
But In all the years and all the times this happened, I never once saw him in the room.
And this happened more than a few times.
Well, more than a few dozen times.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
It sounds like he kept you in business by himself, practically.
That's... Well, he was a good customer.
Yeah, I should say. Well, all right. When you saw Howard Hughes finally, under what circumstance was it? You say you actually met him three times.
Well, the time that really stands out in my mind is the only time that he ever came into the store.
Huh?
And this was on Rodeo Drive. I had gotten a call and told that he wanted to have a sable coat made for this particular girl.
Mm-hmm.
And Michael Wolf was a designer that was working originally for RKO, and after the studio had been sold, he still was on the payroll of Howard Hughes. A pattern was delivered to me for the sable coat that Howard Hughes wanted made. He had not looked at these skins. I had given them the price, which was a very expensive coat. And then I got a call that Mr. Hughes wanted to come into the store, which surprised me because he had never been into the store before. I think it was about 11:30 or 12 o'clock at night when he mm-hmm. came into the store. Mm. Of course, the store had been closed since 6. And he wanted to see the sables that we were going to make into the mm-hmm. coat. Mm-hmm. We went into my workshop in the back of the store. I opened a bundle of the skins that we were going to use. And he said, they're very pretty. Laid out the pattern. He took the skins and laid them out as though he was designing an airplane. And of course he didn't know that the larger skins were for the body of the coat, and the smaller, with the female skins, which were smaller, were to be used for the sleeve.
Mm-hmm.
But he laid them out according to the color, the way he thought they were going to be. Later on, of course, which I never told him, and I never said this to any of them there, we just put all the skins back out and then made it the way it should have been.
So he was under the impression that he actually probably
designed
that.
Yeah, he was.
That.
Not only that, but the girl that he gave it to, was also under the impression, because when she came into the store, she told me, she said, did Howard really make this, work on this himself with you? And I said, he sure did.
Yeah.
So obviously he told her that he had planned everything and so forth,
That's funny. What other stories about Howard Hughes had come to mind? Any?
Well, the other story was, of course, when I was managing Mario Lanza.
Oh, yeah.
Actually, after all the problems with MGM and all the bad publicity that came out of the litigation and so forth, nobody in Hollywood would hire him. So the only person that I knew that really had no worries about anybody or anything was Howard Hughes. And I called and asked if he would be, I called and asked, not him, but one of his men, mm-hmm. if he would ask him if he would be interested in doing Howard Hughes' Mario Lanza movie. And then I got a call from Howard Hughes himself, and he said, yes. He said, I think your guy has got the greatest voice I've ever heard. And he said, what does he want to do? And I said, I'll find out. Well, when I talked to Mario, he had read the book Serenade by James Cain. So I called him back and I said, he wants to do, Serenade by James Cain. He said, well, fine. Then of course that story was owned by Warner Brothers. And of course, I had never read the book, and I didn't know what the story was. The book story was of a gay man with a gay manager, and the gay singer wants to go to be straight. Well, in those years, the gays were unfortunately not treated as ordinary human beings. You know, a gay person could only be treated as a funny individual. You know,
like a comic character.
It was a comic character,
yeah,
which was
right.
Totally unfair. But that's the way they were treated at that time.
Interesting. Stand by, Al. We have to pause just for a couple minutes. We'll come right back and hear this amazing story. That who knows these things? No one but Al Teitelbaum, talking about how Howard Hughes wanted to make a motion picture and what happened. This is in the about 1954. Back in just a couple minutes as we continue. All right, let's get right back to our guest, Al Teitelbaum. This is 1954, and Mario Lanza, of course, had been the biggest earning box office star for MGM in 1951. His film, The Great Caruso, was the top moneymaker of the year. He made another film in 52, and 53 had some very serious problems with the studios with the film The Student Prince, and no one wanted to hire him after that. He was sued by MGM, and Al, being Mario's manager, went to Howard Hughes, as you heard, and Howard said, "Fine, let's do it. Let's make a film." Now, Mario picked a book, Al, that had a gay singer and a gay manager, and the singer wanted to go straight. This is not exactly something that would have been big box office. Obviously, Mario wanted to rewrite the story, the storyline.
That's right. He did not want to appear as a gay man.
Right.
So, anyhow, We supposedly made a deal with Howard Hughes, and
a verbal deal,
and Howard Hughes started to dicker with Warner Brothers to buy the screen rights which Warner Brothers owned, and everything was going along very smooth, and then Mario said, "You think Howard Hughes wants me to do a duet with Jane Russell?" I said, "I have no idea." He said, "Well, because if he does, I'm not going to do it." He said, "If I'm going to do a duet with someone, it's got to be an opera star."
And Jane Russell, of course, was Howard Hughes' big project at the time.
At the time. So, and he had also, Howard Hughes had made another movie, which he didn't like, and he just shelved it. So I thought, gosh, if we make the movie and if he holds it up or shelves it, they'll figure that that'll kill Mario's career. And also, so I insisted on two things. One, that we had the right to approve the leading lady and the right to have the motion picture put on the screen X amount of months after it was completed.
Right.
And at that point, everything stopped. All of a sudden, we didn't hear from Hughes at all, and things just came to a dead end because of those two things. So this went on and on and on for. Previously, there was all kinds of other delays, and every time there was a delay, I would call up Greg Baltzer, who was one of Howard Hughes' attorneys, and tell him that, look, you know, this is going on and on and on, and Mario's getting very jittery about this. Then Howard Hughes would call Mario and talk to him for 2-3 hours on the telephone. And, of course, there were stories about Mario meeting with Howard Hughes. So Mario never met Howard Hughes, but he had many conversations with him on the telephone. Anyhow, Luella Parsons, who at that time was one of the most, if not the most important columnist in Hollywood, was also a customer of mine. And she came into the store one time, and she said, "Al, she said, is the reason that the picture with Howard Hughes is being delayed is because Mario has lost his voice. And I said, of course not. Mario's voice is as good as ever. Well, she said, I was at a party at Xanax and some friends of his, and I thought, God, these are some friends, said that Mario had lost his voice, and that's why the picture was being delayed all this time. So I called up Greg Bowser, and I said, look, we've reached a point here where we can't wait anymore. Either we get this thing settled, or we're going to go look for another deal somewhere else. And I said, I know that you're, you know, also I'd hired Greg Bowser to be Mario Lanza's attorney also. And I said, I know that, you know, naturally, Howard Hughes is a much more important, you know, client of yours than Mario Lanza and Al Teitelbaum. I said, if you like, I'll get somebody else to handle this. And then afterwards, you'll handle everything. Oh, no, he said, I'll tend to it. I said, well, look, if we don't hear by Friday, we're going to consider the deal dead. And he said, okay. So then Friday came, and my store usually, you know, closed at 6 o'clock in the evening.
Right.
And I sat there at the store, everything locked all by myself in my office. And 9, 10, 11 o'clock, by 11 o'clock I hadn't heard anything, so I knew the deal was dead. And I thought, gee, you know, I did a terrible thing. I may have wrecked Mario's career. I mean, here I bounced off Howard Hughes, which was, at that time, I thought was the only ball game in town, you know?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Well, as far as I knew, Mario didn't know that I had given an ultimatum to Howard Hughes. As far as I knew, the only ones that knew were Greg Bowser, myself, and Howard Hughes. Well, the next morning, this was on a Friday night, the next morning, when I got to the store, Steve Trilling was waiting for me. Steve Trilling was the manager of Warner Brothers Studio.
Mm-hmm.
And I had done business with him and his wife for some time. Because Ann Warner, Jack Warner's wife, was one of my best customers.
Mm.
Anything new that came out, she wanted to be the first one in the country to have it. Anyhow, he said to me, Al, he said, I understand your deal with Hughes blew up last night, which shocked me. I thought, how does he know, you know?
Yeah, one wonders how he did know, unless the phone was tapped.
I never did know how he knew, but he knew.
How mysterious. All right, well, we have to pause here, but when we come back, we have a longer segment. We'll finish the story. This is a fascinating look at how one film deal came to eventually be made, thanks to the persistence in this case of Al Teitelbaum. But very few people give ultimatums to Howard Hughes and get away with it. This is a fascinating story. Stand by, and we'll do this couple-minute break and come right back with much more. Okay, let's get right back to this an unheard story about Howard Hughes and how one motion picture deal was made, lost, and then made again. Go ahead, Al. So Steve Trilling, another name from Hollywood's great era. If you folks out there like Hollywood the movies, you'll remember the name Greg Bowser and the name Steve Trilling. So Trilling calls you and said, I understand the deal with Howard Hughes.
No, he didn't call. He was actually at the store at my office waiting for me.
He made a personal call. Oh, waiting for you. All right.
And so he said to me, I understand your deal with Hughes blew up last night.
You must have been thunderstruck.
I was really sick to my heart, figuring I had done a terrible thing by, you know, giving Hughes an ultimatum.
Right, because it would hurt Mario. Yeah.
Yeah, I figured that I'd really done a very bad thing to Mario's career. So he said, we own the rights to Serenade. And I said, I know that. Howard, if Hughes had been dickering with you. Well, he said, we'd like to make the movie. He said, what was the deal with Howard Hughes? So I explained to him exactly what the deal was. And he said, well, we'll make it. And
just like that.
And we shook hands, and he said, let me call up the colonel. The colonel was Jack Warner. During the war, I don't know if he became an honorary colonel or an actual colonel, but he liked to be called colonel. So he got him on the phone, and he said, I'm sitting here with Al Teitelbaum, and we've just made a deal to do a serenade with Mario Lanza. So he handed me the phone, and he said, he wants to talk to you. So he said to me, well, he said, I'm delighted. He said, you know, he said, I met Mario, he said, during the war. He was at a party we gave. I could have had him for peanuts in those years. He said, but when he came up to the place, he was a big, fat, disheveled soldier, you know? And, of course, I had not known Mario when, you know, at that period.
Mm-hmm.
And, he said, we'll be delighted. So that's how that's how the deal was made. This was on a Saturday.
Yeah.
So then, as soon as, Steve Trilling left, I called up Mario and told him that we're going to make the serenade, but we're going to do it at Warner Brothers. And he wanted to know why, what had happened with Howard Hughes. And I said, well, he's involved with so many other projects. I didn't want to tell him exactly what had happened. I just said he's involved with so many other projects
mm-hmm.
that if, you know how long this thing has dragged on. I said it would drag on with Hughes for months and months more. So he was happy. So then he said, I'm going to call up Hedda Hopper. And I said, well, I'll call up Luella Parsons and let them know that we've just made the deal with Warner Brothers. So, on Sunday, in those years, those columnists have a very important column in each one of the newspapers. Of course, Luella Parsons was in all the Hearst newspapers.
Right.
The Hedda Hopper was primarily the Times. And each one of them headed the column the same way. Mario Lanza signs to do a serenade with Warner Brothers. And they went on with a little story after that. And, meanwhile, I had called Lou Wasserman at that time was MCA, and he was the head of MCA.
Another famous name from the past.
And, Lou Wasserman was probably one of the brightest motion picture men I had ever met in my life.
Mm-hmm.
And, I told him, you know, that we had just switched the deal to Warner Brothers. And he said, I think that's a better idea. And, then they were going to get to work on the details of the contract and so forth. And, this was Saturday. Now, Sunday, the articles came out, you know, about Mario signing with Warner Brothers.
Big headline on Sunday, sure.
Yeah, it was on the, now on Monday morning, I got to my office and, my secretary said that, Greg Bowser had called twice and said that he needs to talk to you. So I got into my office and I put in a call to Greg Bowser and he said, I'm on another call. Can I call you back in 10 minutes? But please stay there. I need to talk to you. So, I waited for 10 minutes and I called him back and he said, Al, he said, Howard Hughes has agreed to, you know, to the things that you and Mario wanted and we're all set to go. I said, well, you know, we've already made a deal with Warner Brothers. He said, well, nothing's been signed. And I said, well, you know, nothing's been signed, but, you know, we have a deal with Warner Brothers. And he said, well, I'd like you to consider, you know, making the change to Howard Hughes. I said, we can't do it. Anyhow, there were other things that came out in that conversation, but the wind-up was that I wouldn't budge with that because basically if we made changes there, people would feel that Mario's word was no good, my word was no good, you know.
Oh, sure.
So we left it just as that. I thought probably I'd lost Howard Hughes as a customer.
Over that, yeah.
Yeah. The end was later on, he wanted me to go to work for him, so instead of losing him, he became more friendly to me than ever before. Anyhow.
He probably respected you, Al. First of all, you gave him an ultimatum, and then you stood by your word. I mean, that's not exactly common, even in, especially in business today.
Well, if we had, Mario would never have been able to make another movie, you know? Anyhow, then they started working on the script. And that was a tough one. They changed the game manager to a wealthy society gal. Actually, you mentioned Joan Fontaine. She was the one that played that role in the Serenade.
Yes, I know. Mm-hmm.
And the story is, of course, that this singer goes to Mexico to get away from his manager. And he meets this girl in Mexico that he falls in love with, and she changes his lifestyle. And that's the way actually the motion picture was made.
Right. I wonder if Mr. Kane objected. Probably not. He got his money. It had already been optioned by Warner, so he was taken care of. Yeah.
I don't know what the deal was with James Kane. All I know is that whatever deal he had it with Warner Brothers, and we never were part of that deal. They owned the rights to it, and they made it. Of course, the story, by the changes, it didn't show anything as the story had read in the book.
Right, right. Well, there it is, folks. That's just how one movie deal was made in Hollywood. They used to make 500 and 600 films a year. And where a man's word was his word, at least in this case. All right, we'll be right back with Al Teitelbaum after this. And welcome back. A conversation with Al Teitelbaum tonight, a truly living legend, if there ever was one, from the golden era of Hollywood. Furs by Teitelbaum. You'll see that at the end of countless motion picture credit rolls and the stories Al has. You know, another couple words about Mario. There are many other things to talk about, Al. And I just wanted to say, you mentioned once to me in all the years you knew and worked and played such a key role in Mario Lanza's continuing career. You said to me once that his voice, of course, as everyone knows, was magnificent, but you have never heard it accurately reproduced on any record, that the voice was better than any record could contain. Is that, tell
That's
me more
absolutely
about that.
True. I don't think any recording ever really truly showed how great his voice was. When you listen to him in person, it's a different feeling entirely. I mean, you know, I've heard a lot of great voices in my lifetime. I honestly and truly, not because I loved Mario, but because I honestly and truly believe that there never was anybody that had a voice as great as his. And even the three great tenors today all said the same thing, that Mario's voice inspired them. I mean, but you could not really get the entire feeling of his voice by listening to it on a record. You had to hear him in person.
What was it like? I mean, you heard him many, many times. When you heard that sound come out of him, it must have made your hair stand up on end sometimes. Almost superhuman, wasn't it?
I really thought it was. And of course, Mario, when he sang, he really believed every single note that he sang, every word in the song, and it showed it in his singing.
Mm-hmm.
He really, the only way I can describe it, he sang from his soul.
He didn't just sing the words.
The words.
Yeah. Now, well, you can hear that in the records today, that he was living the experience and like no one else.
No.
There are some great singers out there who are technically wonderful, but there probably will never be another one. It seemed as if, and you knew the man so well, but it seems to me that he had as much passion in him as any three or four human beings.
Oh, I think that's absolutely true. There was only one Mario, and I don't believe there'll be another one. Certainly not in my lifetime.
Yeah, or mine. Let's talk about some of the studio chiefs. We it is said that had Louis B. Mayer not been fired by Lowe's and removed from MGM, that Mario would have made probably many more pictures at MGM.
I think so. Louis B. Mayer had respect, and he understood talent probably better than anybody else in Hollywood. He loved talent. MGM Studios was to him his baby. And he spent his whole life there.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, studio politics and money, you know. Of course, today, none of the studios, there aren't any studios anymore. They're just places where you make a picture occasionally, you know. They're owned by different corporations. But Louis B. Mayer, he would search the entire world for talent. It wasn't only actors and actresses. It was screenwriters, technicians. He built up the most important studio in the world at the time because of his idea that everything he made had to be the best.
I like that idea.
I've
told our audience that for years, our listeners, Al. That
well, it's absolutely true.
Whatever it is you do in life, doesn't matter. Just do your best, the best you can.
You know, there were several people in Hollywood, like Samuel Golden, for example, who didn't make too many movies, but every movie he made, he wanted it to be, quoting him, a wonderful movie.
Mm-hmm.
And he may have butchered the language at times when things that he said, but he really loved making movies, and he hired the best people that he could.
I heard him on a Jack Benny recording once, and he did have a funny way of talking, but obviously a great sense of humor.
Yeah, he did have a great sense of humor.
Was Louis B. Mayer imperious in his demeanor, or was he a good guy at heart? What was he like?
Well, of course, my experience with him was he was a good guy, you know?
Mm-hmm.
He acted as though he was very important, which he was, you know?
He was.
He knew that he was the king of Hollywood.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody else knew it, too. And everybody else had a great deal of respect for him. And when you walked into MGM, you go into the commissary and you looked around, you saw almost every big name in Hollywood there.
Not
only the actor and actresses, but the directors, the producers, you know.
Mm-hmm. Not like that anymore.
No, because the studio system doesn't exist anymore.
Right.
And, you know, which is a shame because you get an actor out there and he's really on his own. He makes the movie, and he doesn't know what to do from that point on. The movie either becomes a success or it becomes a flop, because he hasn't been built up to the fact where he has the ability to really act.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you look at the movies today, there's a lot of movies that have been very successful money-wise, a lot of them because I think of the technicians that make the movie, rather than the actors and actresses in them. But you don't have the really fine actors that you had a generation ago.
When Louis Mayer was fired, that must have really shaken up Hollywood, I would think.
It really did. And then, of course, they put in Doris Sherry, who was also a good customer of mine.
Mm-hmm.
Doris Sherry had been at RKO, and the next thing I knew, he was president of MGM Studios.
Yeah, didn't know how to handle people nearly as well as Louis Mayer.
I don't know of anybody that could handle people as well as Louis B. Mayer. it used to be a joke there that an actor would go into Louis B. Mayer's office to ask for a raise, and by the time he got through with talking to Louis B. Mayer, he felt that he was overpaid, and maybe he should ask for a reduction in salary. That was the joke there. I think that Louis B. Mayer was probably one of the best actors in Hollywood anyway.
Well, that's an interesting statement. Wow. Harry Cohen at Columbia, what kind of a character is he? He's gotten kind of a bad rap in some of the books.
He was a tough man. I mean, he was a tough guy. And he was an entirely different type of person than Louis B. Mayer. And, well, what can I say except that he was a tough man.
Was he a customer of yours, too?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. See what I'm trying to tell you about Al Teitelbaum. Al, I know Al enough that he, to this day, will honor confidences. It's just not done anymore. He's not someone to tell stories about people unnecessarily. Tough guy, Harry Cohn. And I guess, we should spend some time we've talked about Howard Hughes, about Louis Mayer, a little bit about Harry Cohn. That's about all you want to say about Harry at this point, huh?
Well, yeah, he was a businessman.
Mm-hmm.
And motion pictures to him were making, you know, was a business.
Wasn't an art form.
No, with Louis B. Mayer and Sam Goldwyn, it was an art form.
And we go to Warner's with Jack and Harry.
And Harry Warner.
How'd you like them?
I like them, especially Harry Warner. But my dealings with Jack Warner were fine. Ann Warner, as I say, was one of my big customers.
Mm-hmm. Would she come in and say, there's a new the blue sable that I saw or heard about. I need to have one right away, that kind of thing?
Absolutely. She wanted to be the first one, and she really was. When the first of the new colored minks, you know,
mm-hmm.
came in, when they first had the silver blue, mm-hmm. she had the first one, I believe the first one in the country. And as they developed new breeds of, you know, different, I shouldn't say new breeds, but different colors of the minks,
mm-hmm.
she always wanted to be the first one to have one. And she did. I remember when we used to give fashion shows, and where we would have, each year we'd have my whole collection. And it was usually was in the Beverly Hills Hotel.
Wow, it must have been quite a night.
It was. You'd have 500 people that were invited.
Wow.
And I remember that she came into the store before we had the fashion show, and we had the models model everything for her, and she picked out maybe 15 items out of the fashion show that she wanted.
15?
15.
Wow.
And she was going to Europe, and she wanted to take them with her. And I said, we can't. I've got these all in the catalog and so forth, you know. Anyhow, what we did, we had the fashion show, and when we got through with the fashion show, the items that she had picked, I had Frank Stopper, who was my manager of my store, flew with everything to New York and met her at the boat and delivered everything to her on the boat. I didn't want to ruin my fashion show by taking some of the highlights out of it, you know.
Funny story. Wow. 500 invited guests. What an experience that must have been. Oh, wonderful. Stand by, Al, if you would, and love to hear about some of the individual stars next, if we can. And we'll continue with Al Teitelbaum in just a few minutes.